another edition of Sad Times. I just said that like a radio robot. Radio robots. Man, I tell you what, this is Kevin. This is Sad Times. Thank you so much for listening. For those of you who have never listened, welcome. Let me give you a quick primer. Sad Times is a show in which each week we have a kind and generous guest who comes on and tells their story, talks about times that they were upset, sad, angry, abused, trauma they've gone through, processing trauma, very difficult things. Because at Sad Times, we believe that difficult stories are universal, but they are not universally told. And so we are hoping that these stories, as they are shared, can help you, wherever you may be listening, feel a little bit less alone. Maybe you'll hear something and say, I thought I was the only one who had dealt with that, or I thought I was the only one who had that thought. The goal, again, is to help others feel less alone. So that's what Sad Times is. Because it is post-1995, we have a website, and it is www.sadtimespodcast.com. I don't know why Brent is smiling at the post-1995. I don't know. I hear 1995. I think Netscape, Brent. You know, what are you going to do? That's www.sadtimespodcast.com. Go there. You can check out all our episodes. And of course, please subscribe wherever it is that podcasts magically appear on your phone or device. So that's Sad Times. And we at Sad Times have to pay the bills. And so before we get to our wonderful guest, let's go to this week's sponsor. So this week, Sad Times is brought to you by the faces I make when trying to get my face ID on my phone to work. You ever want to feel depressed about your countenance? Or in my case, more depressed? Well, just try to look at your bank app on your smartphone when you know you need to know how much money you have and make 14 different faces of various contortions while coming back to accept that your face is just terrible. That's the faces I make when trying to get my face ID to work, faces I won't even make when listening to a brilliant Tom Waits song. All right. Well, as always, we do want everyone to support our sponsors. So please support our sponsors by using the code FAKE. That's FAKE at checkout. All right. The bills are paid. Brent, my producer, Wade, the intern. We'll call you an intern. Sure. I think we're good to go. And we have a wonderful guest today with a really amazing story. Her name is Mimi. Hey, Mimi, how are you doing?
I'm just great. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I finally got I opened that water bottle like 2.5 minutes ago. Then I was like, oh no, Kevin, it's your show. You have to talk. So I was not able to drink the water until now. So I'm doing well. And where are you today, Mimi?
Well, I'm in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Well, not bad. Not bad at all. And you said you're having a cold spell as of recording. And I'm just because I want to get mad again. Tell me how cold that is.
60.
Oh, that's rough. That's rough.
Man. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So you got a cold spell. What is it usually there? What is the general?
For winter, we usually don't need our heater on. So that gives you some idea what winter like is like, right? Yeah. So I have my heater on today. I'm using the heating.
Oh.
And so normally you don't need that. Normally it's about 65, 70 in the winter.
Wow. And how long have you lived down there?
20 years.
Wow. Oh, gosh. So, well, and we're going to talk about it here in a moment. You're from Pennsylvania, so you obviously dealt with some pretty hardcore cold, I'm sure, growing up. And when you lived there, have you, in your travels, perhaps in the last 20 years, have you left West Palm Beach and gone somewhere cold and just been, like, totally floored by how cold it is? Or is it something that you can still be used to because of all the years you spent in the cold?
No, it's worse. We were just there for my oldest daughter's wedding. She decided to get married on New Year's Eve, and it was cold.
Ooh.
Very cold.
Yeah, that's so, and it's not any easier, and it's just horrible.
It's horrible. It's worse.
Yeah. And you're like, I'm just, all right, good. You're married. All right. I'm on my way. I'm out of here.
Actually, yes. We left the next day.
Hey, why not? You're there for the wedding, you know?
I know. We left before the ceremony, the reception was over.
Oh, I thought you were going to say before the ceremony, to which I was going to say, now, Mimi, that's rude. Yeah.
I left before the midnight toast or whatever.
Oh, makes sense. Yeah. I somehow made it to midnight this year, and that was the first time in a long while that I'd made it to midnight at New Year's. We are recording in February for anybody who's worried about the cold that Mimi is experiencing right now down in West Palm Beach. So, Mimi, I mentioned Pennsylvania. you are from Scranton, Pennsylvania. So tell us about, and we're going to cover a lot of topics today, and I just want to say to anyone who is listening that just a warning, there will be some, unfortunately, be some discussions of violence and abuse, so please take care while listening. Mimi, tell us about where you're from and growing up and what your parents were like.
Sure. Well, Scranton is also the birthplace of our president, Joe Biden.
Damn right.
Yes, it is. And I'll tell you what, he is the epitome of what Scrantonians sound like and act like.
Really?
Yes. Yes. We're kind of like, no bull, you know, this is it. He doesn't sugarcoat things, that kind of thing. And he's older than me, so I really never met him, but I did meet his brother. I know his brother, Frank.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So we grew up, when we grew up in Scranton, it was beautiful. It was ideal. It was 99% white, which it just was. A lot of different religions, but back in that day, it was like, if you are Catholic, you couldn't have Protestant friends. It was just very, very biased.
Okay.
And racist. And racist. So I think I knew three Black people, two that went to my high school. I went to a college prep high school, and a lot of Jewish kids there, so I know a lot about Jewish traditions and everything. And I think I dated a Black guy once, and he had to drop me off a block away from my house.
That's horrible.
Of course it was, but it was in the early 60s. It was before, it was right when all the marches were going on and desegregation. I mean, it was still, you know.
Were you Catholic or Protestant or neither?
I was raised Catholic. I was a good Catholic girl, and I had a friend that was Protestant, and my parents didn't like that. Mm-hmm. And she was in the Girl Scouts, and I wanted to join Girl Scouts, and they said, absolutely not. So I had joined Catholic Daughters, which is the Catholic equivalent of the Girl Scouts.
I never knew there was a Catholic equivalent to the Girl Scouts.
Yeah. Well, it was then Catholic Daughters, it was called.
Wow.
And, you know, that was it. But I lived in a very strict, controlled environment. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother was very cold. And not very demonstrative or supportive. And of course, as a child, you don't know what normal is. You're living in what you think is normal. So I didn't realize that not getting hugs or high fives because you got an A on report card was something that was supposed to be happening.
Right. I mean, it's because that's all you know. You're in your environment. So it's like, okay, this is what life is. And then, you know, we obviously all generally leave home. And then that's when we meet the rest of the world who had a different experience.
That was the problem. My parents' plan was for us to never leave the home and to be worker bees, to have jobs and support them. And that is since like 12, 13 years old.
How old were you when you had your first job? Were you like 12 or 13?
Or even earlier, I think 10. I used to walk a block away where this Jewish woman had a five and dime, if you know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I would go get her dinner at the restaurant down the road and bring it back to her. And sometimes she'd have me watch the shop while she ate. And sometimes she'd clean. And then I'd probably make a quarter. It's really funny. So, you know, it was probably 1958.
Okay.
So I did that. And that money, they didn't take off me. But then when I started a job that paid substantial dollars instead of quarters, then the money was supposed to be given to them. A certain percentage would be left to us. And I actually worked in a Jewish bakery. You could see the town has a lot of Jewish influence in it, too. I worked in a Jewish bakery after school, a night shift, wrapping bread. And in those days, you used to wrap bread in this cellophane and then put it on a hot plate, and it sealed it. So it was kind of dangerous. I got burnt once or twice.
Ooh, yeah.
Then I would go home after working there maybe 4 hours and do my homework. So, and I was 16 when I had that job. And yeah.
Earlier in your life, you had told me too that one of your earliest memories was that you were five and you were looking forward to go into kindergarten, you know, starting school. Tell us what happened instead.
Well, I was five. My brother was four. We're very close in age, and we were always very close. And my mother was pregnant with their child, and she went into labor, went to the hospital. And in those days, if you had a boy, you stayed like 3 or 4 days in the hospital and until they circumcised the child. It was a whole big, complicated, antiquated thing.
Uh-huh.
And I had a grandmother and I had four aunts. And my parents said in later life when I was older, the reason they put me in St. Joseph's for 5 days was because they had no one to take care of us.
And St. Joseph's is an orphanage?
It's an orphanage, yes. And the ironic part of it is that was the orphanage that my father was in before he was adopted.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of bizarro, you know. And we got dropped off in the orphanage and said, I'll be back soon. And
did they explain to you what was going on?
They just said, well, we have nobody to watch you until mommy comes home from the hospital.
Gotcha.
That was it.
Okay.
But we, as 5 and 4 year olds, we just felt abandoned and scared.
Of course. Yeah.
And unfortunately, they also separated the boys from the girls. So they immediately took my brother away from me and put him in the boys' dorm. And I was in the girls' dorm. And I didn't see him again till the next morning when we went out to the playground. And he saw me and he ran over and hugged me, almost knocked me down. And he tells me to this day that he was so thrilled when he saw me because he was scared. He was four. You know, he was 4 years old.
Did they, when they separated you, did they say you're going to be able to see each other again, or was it just a separation? And
all the nuns were very strict. They just said girls with girls, boys with boys. So you really didn't know what that meant. You know, really, you didn't till the next day when then for breakfast and playground, then you mingled. So yeah, it was a little bit traumatic.
I'd say, I mean, especially at that age and to have one expectation and then to be left alone with strangers, to be taken away from your brother. And then, so what was there when you said 5 days you guys were in there?
I think so. And I guess my father came in a day or two and he brought us each a Hershey bar and he said, okay, I'm going to be back and I'll take you home when I come back. And he left, and the nuns took the Hershey bars, and we never saw them again.
What the fuck, man?
I know.
They took the Hershey bars? Your one source of comfort?
Yeah. So, but then the crowning glory of all this was I didn't go to kindergarten because my brother had been born October 6th, and I don't know if I had a day or two in kindergarten. I don't know. But I did not go to kindergarten after he was born, for sure.
What did you do?
I was at home. I was at home.
And you were just helping?
Well, yeah. From 5, I became a caretaker because my mother worked days and my father worked nights. So basically, my dad would be home until like 3:30, and my mother would get home by maybe 4, 4:30. So that interim in between, I was in charge.
Because you were the oldest, right? Of four?
The oldest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I took it very seriously. And I have a sister that's 10 years younger than me. And basically, I raised her. I was more of her mother than her sister.
And are you two still very close?
Well, we could be closer, but she has a drug and alcohol problem. And
gotcha.
We just text a lot. Once in a while, we'll talk on the phone, but, you know, it's kind of hard to to keep up a relationship in that situation, you know?
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have it. It's just the way it is. Yeah.
And, okay, so you obviously went back to school at some point.
Yes, first grade.
And and your dream was to be a high school English teacher. And what what did your parents say when you told them that?
They just act like, okay, you know, fine. They didn't say, oh, that's wonderful or anything. Like I said, you didn't get that kind of motivation or support that, and I didn't know, like I said, I didn't know other people did get that from their parents. I didn't know. So, the thing was, my father, when he was not drinking, was pretty good, but he was like a binge drinker because he worked. So he would drink on the weekends. Yeah, that was the thing. So weekends were kind of hellish, to say the least.
Would he be, he'd become angry and volatile when he was drunk?
Yes.
Gotcha.
He was in the orphanage till he was 4 years old, the same orphanage that I was put in. And, he got adopted by an Italian couple, and the woman was very, very mean to him growing up because they knew who his mother was, and she was Irish. And the man that adopted him, for whatever reason, I guess macho something, he said he was his real biological father, which was a lie. I think he wanted, he didn't want people to think he couldn't father a child, kind of person like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, again, we're talking the 1940s. So he told my father that I'm your father, but your mother was Irish and she gave you up. So of course he hated the Irish because he thought his mother gave him up. Right. But it was all a fairy tale because when I did DNA years later, I found out he was 100% Irish, which meant both parents were Irish.
Oh, okay.
So I got the birth certificate from St. Joseph's Orphanage, and it had his name, and it had the mother's name, and his birth name would have been, well, his mother's name was Judge, but his father's name was Scanlon.
Okay.
So I got all that information, and it was shocking, you know, because he even knew how to talk Sicilian. We met all these relatives from Sicily. Like, we all totally bought the lie.
Was that, that's not the right, so shocking. Did that really jar you? Like, did you feel like you'd been lied to or anything of that nature?
Well, I actually felt sympathy for him because that's why he drank. A lot of it was what he went through as a child also, and feeling of not being part of somebody, and his adoptee mother, whatever you want to call her family did not treat him well either. He was shunned. So he grew up with that. And I found out through the DNA that he had a half-brother that lived six blocks away his whole life and never knew him.
Wow.
And that, to me, was shocking. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That, I mean, that's very sad.
Well, I wrote another book on that.
Yeah, okay.
That's a whole different book. I did find a first cousin, blood relative, and she had lived, that was her father, and she had lived six blocks away, and I never knew her because she was younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me all the dirt. She spilled the tea about that side of the family and how terrible they were, drunks and philanderers. And actually, her grandfather is my biological grandfather, and I think he raped my grandmother, because when I did my history research, my father was born. His mother was 14 when he was born, and the father was 26. You know, so I'm kind of like, I don't know what my father would have done with this information. I don't think it would have been good. So it's good.
It's just horrible. And it sounds like that he, so much that he had gone through just being an orphan up to four alone, you know, but So you said your dad was an alcoholic. You said your mom was kind of cold and detached.
Yeah.
Listen. You ended up going to school. You put yourself through college.
Yeah, and I wanted to go. I wanted to go after high school with everybody else.
And what did you do after high school? Did you have to continue to stay at home and help?
Well, that's what happened. I graduated. We had class day and everything, the prom and all that stuff. And my parents sat me down and they gave me a watch for graduation present. And they informed me that I would not be going to college because I needed to get a job and help support the family.
Had you already applied or what?
I was going to go to Marywood.
Okay. And what was your reaction to that?
I was angry. I was sad. I was crying.
Yeah.
And then the worst part of it was my mother got me a job working with her in a pants factory, which that is not where I needed to be.
Mm.
I mean, I was pretty smart. And of course, I wanted to be a teacher. And I'm sewing, trying to learn how to sew a certain part of the pants. That's how they did it. Piecework, it's called. And I have women next to me that are talking dirty like truck drivers. And I'm this innocent Catholic girl, but no experience of the world, and I hated it. So luckily, I looked and looked and I found a good job in an office. I got a job at Capitol Records because at the time, Capitol Records had an office in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Wow. What year was this?
1966.
Ooh, that's, man, what a great time to work at Capitol Records.
Yeah, I met the Righteous Brothers. And
really?
So it was called, they used to have, you would join the record club in the day, and you would choose records, and they would send them to you in the mail. So my job was customer service, and I would deal with people that said, oh, the record was defective, or I don't like it, I want my money back, all that. That kind of stuff, customer service.
Right.
I loved it. It was just what I would like to be doing if I couldn't be a teacher, and I made friends there. So that was great.
And how long were you there?
I was there a couple years, and Capitol Records decided that they wanted a full operation to be in Los Angeles, California. And that's when they built that round building that you always see in every movie. I was asked to go to California and train the people there. I would be given airfare, a place to stay, and my other friend was also going to go. I was so thrilled. I mean, I had the plane ticket in my hand. I go home. I tell my parents. My father took a fit. He said, "You are not going. If you try to go, I will throw myself in front of the airplane." A little dramatic.
A little bit.
Yeah. So I was young and I was naive and I was controlled all my life so far. I didn't have the wherewithal to stand up to him. And I didn't have the cunning to run away. I just stayed there.
Yeah.
Gave that opportunity up.
That breaks my heart to hear that. And
well, say one thing. Every time there's a movie and they show the Capitol Records building, I get so pissed off.
I could have been there. Understandably so. So you did end up going to the University of Scranton. And
28 years old.
At 28. Okay. And you owned a couple of bars, one in 1980 and one in 1987. But you bartended at a hotel in the 70s.
Yeah.
Tell us about your boyfriend at the time and kind of who you met through your boyfriend.
Well, thing of it was, I had a short marriage because that was the only way I could get out of that house. You could see I was imprisoned. And the only way you could get out was to get married. So I did get married and he was cute and sexy. And I thought, oh, this is my ticket out. But he drank, he cheated on me. And I think the marriage lasted 18 months, but now I was free. I was out and I got a job at the Hotel Casey bartending, and they gave me a room to stay in and everything. And I did it. And yeah, it was the 70s. So it was fun. I was smoking pot. I was going to the disco.
Sure.
Yeah. So I would work till 2 o'clock in the morning. And the disco across the street from the Hotel Casey was after hours. It would stay open. So a lot of times too, I'd close a little early if nobody was there. And I would like to go over there. So I met, there was a lot of sort of seedy criminal types that hung around the bar. And a lot of famous people and politicians too. It was a very famous hotel at the time. And I had met this guy, and he was, I believe, I don't want to use the word mafia, but he was definitely connected somehow. And he couldn't be with me all the time because he was married. So he asked the bouncer at the disco to go over every night and walk me across the street because it was downtown, you know, downtown Scranton.
Okay.
So I had a bodyguard. Oh.
Okay. Yeah. So you have a bodyguard just to walk you across the street.
The street, because it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Yes. And that went on for a short time because now we didn't have cell phones, et cetera. But we had a payphone in the Hotel Casey bar. The one guy that was a bookie used to use it as his office. He'd sit at the bar and the payphone would ring and it'd be for him, and people would place bets, right?
Oh, okay.
So the one day it rang when I was working, he was not there. I answered it and a voice said, "If you keep going out with so-and-so, they're going to find you dead in the street." So I went to myself, no, I don't like him that much. So I broke that off.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second, Mimi. So you're talking about, okay, so the man that you were kind of dating was married. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
And you got a call from somebody who said, "You better stop dating him or you're going to be killed." And so you thought, well, I like living.
Yeah.
So so you broke that off, and who did you go, get into another relationship?
I was dating, nobody serious, but the bouncer, my bodyguard, he insisted on continuing his routine of walking me across the street, and he would always ask me out, and I'd say, "You're not my type," because he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So he was persistent, and he would keep asking me. And I said, "Well, maybe if you change your look. I don't like your hair, and I don't like the way you dress." So he went and he did that.
Wow.
Like, he cleaned up for me, you know? And so I said, "Okay, I'll go out with you." And then, of course, he went full throttle with the wooing and the courting and just all taking me to expensive places and everything else. So kind of won me over. And he was a big guy, but you know, sometimes these big guys are just teddy bears inside. And that's how I kind of looked at him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never felt threatened by his size or anything. And he was always nice to me. He was good to me. And I wanted children. And my biological clock was kind of pushing me a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. So when he asked me to marry him, I said, "Yes." Which was a big mistake.
Well, and how old were you when you got married?
Oh, gosh, let me see. Let me do the numbers. The second time. Don't forget I got married.
I'm sorry. You're right. I'm sorry. When you got married to the bodyguard.
But that was a movie, wasn't it? I believe I was 23.
23. Okay. And did you have, obviously, you mentioned earlier in the episode that, you know, you have an older daughter. So you did have, how many children did you have?
I ended up having 2 girls with him. Yeah, 2 girls, and they were 18 months apart. I actually didn't want to have a second child because I saw that it was not a good marriage. But I got pregnant, and being a good Catholic, I'm going to keep it, you know. So I ended up with 2 children, 18 months apart.
Okay. Well, what made it not a good marriage? Well, I know that's a hard, big question, not an easy answer, but.
Well, the main thing, this is a main thing, was he wasn't bringing money into the house. okay?
Mm-hmm.
And really couldn't work with two little kids, you know? And even right. if I tried, I don't know what I would have done to work. And so there was that. He wasn't bringing money into the house. He was very controlling. And he would go out at night, and he, a lot of his work was at night. He was collecting debts for the, whatever you want to call these people, the seedy people, the bookies. He's a debt collector, and he also would run card games, right? And when you do that, you can't play. You can just deal, and you get what's called a vigorish, which is a percentage of the pot. So basically, he was not doing a regular job, and there was not like a definite amount of money coming in.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And, wow.
And he considered himself a pool hustler, but I don't think, again, he wasn't good enough to bring enough money.
Like Fast Eddie? Like,
yeah.
Okay.
He thought he was, well, not the Paul Newman character, the heavy one.
Oh, Minnesota Fats?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah, Jackie Gleason? Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, he's out at night carousing. And at that time, everyone that knew him and my friends and everyone said, you know, he is in love with you, though. He doesn't look at any other women. He, you know, it's definitely you, which was one of the reasons that I stayed in the marriage, because my first husband had cheated and I was giving him these extra points for being faithful. But again, I couldn't pay the bills. I had to go on welfare. I had to get food stamps. And he was controlling. Like, if we did get a babysitter and go out, it's like I couldn't talk to anybody. You know, I
was just,
yeah.
And would you get in trouble if you did talk to somebody?
Oh, Lord. Yes. The one night.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, you were going
to
say.
No, I was going to say the one night I was sitting next to someone that was a cross-dresser. And I always saw him as a woman. Whenever I was with him, he would have his nail polish, his hair done, his clothes. He was a woman to me. That's it. And we went to the ladies' room together. And my ex sent a girl in there to tell me to get out right now, or he was coming in. And I came out of the bathroom. I said, what the heck? What's going on? He goes, you just went to the bathroom with a man. I said, that's not a man. When he's dressed like that, he's not a man. That's my thinking, because I'm more liberal than a lot of people. And anyway, there's private stalls. It's not like you're going to the urinal like the men do, right? You're private. So he made a big deal over that. Yeah.
And you
pretty much.
How long did you guys stay married?
7 years.
7 years. And so you got divorced, and that's when you enrolled in college?
Yes. I had tried everything. He did have a job as a bartender for a short time. I thought things were maybe going to work out, but he was still carousing. He was still being controlling. He never hit me, but he was like, well, we were married. I took him to marriage counseling, and Catholic Social Services had it. And he would not talk. And the counselor even tried the thing like, okay, if the ashtray's in front of Marie, she's going to talk. If the ashtray's in front of you, you talk. And when the ashtray was in front of him, he wouldn't say a word. So after a couple sessions, the counselor said, I think I should see you separately.
Mm-hmm.
And then two more sessions went by and the counselor said, forget it. He doesn't talk when he's here alone either. And I'm going to tell you something right now, even though Catholics don't believe in divorce, I think you should divorce him and go to college. That's who gave me the motivation, the marriage counselor.
Well, with everything that you're describing and the controlling nature, after you were able to get a divorce, was that the last you knew of him? Like what?
It escalated. That escalated the abuse. Because he did not recognize the divorce. He would have his friends spying, and if they saw me at a club or a bar, they would tell him, because he was at the same disco, you know, they knew where to find him. And they used to bar hop. So they'd be at one place, go to another, see me, go to the disco and say, oh, just saw her at the at Joe's, you know. And he would leave his place to go up there and verbally assault me and, you know, scare any man that might be talking to me. So that was bad.
So would he like scare, when you say scare any man, would you be on a date and he would like with somebody else and he would show up?
Oh yeah. A guy took me to dinner one night at a very nice restaurant and he found out we were there. He came barreling in, always came in like at a dead run and grabbed my chair, and twisted the chair around and started screaming and yelling at me and everything. And then he left. And then,
what was he yelling at you?
I thought it was a whore and, you know, what am I doing? Why am I, you know, and did you sleep? Did you ask this guy? That kind of stuff. And so I wouldn't get a second date.
Especially if he comes running in there.
I was having trouble getting second dates.
Okay. And you're also raising your kids and you're going to school.
And he's not paying child support.
Was he in the kids' lives?
Not much.
No child support.
No child support. So I don't know how I did it. It was tough. It was tough because of I got daycare for free. Tuition was sort of free. They gave me money to buy a car so I'd have transportation. But by the end of the month, the food stamps would be gone and it would be like, what the hell am I going to make to eat kids? And there used to be a little corner store where I was living and the man was so nice to me. So that last week, every month, I would go in and he would let me run a tab.
Oh, okay. Like run on credit and then you would pay him. Yeah. Oh, that's so very nice.
So I wouldn't have enough food for 4 weeks. I'd only have enough food for 3 weeks because I didn't have any child support. And I, you know, so that went on. And then one day I was on campus and on the quad talking to people and he came up, ran right over the grass and tried to run me over.
Whoa, wait a minute. He came up with his car?
Yes.
And he tried to hit you with his car?
Yeah, he came and I jumped out of the way.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, what happened then? Like, did he get out of the car?
No.
Were you hit? You weren't hit, right?
No, I wasn't hit. It was just a scare tactic. Yeah. That's the kind of thing you would do.
Yeah.
Like, my life was very stressful at the time. So I got 2 years in and I kept going and I would, I fit right in with the kids. Even though I was 28, I got along with everybody. Then, you know, they'd want me to go to the bar with them after class. Things. And I'd say, well, I can't because I have kids I have to pick up at daycare. And I'd take my kids home, feed them, put them to bed, all that. And then to study, I would get out. I hope you know what this is. A bong. You know what a bong is?
I do. I'm aware of what a bong is. Yeah.
I would get out my bong, and instead of putting water in it, I put the pot in. Instead of the water base, I would put wine. That was my thing.
Whoa.
And I would study. And I was a straight A student.
Wow. Okay.
I did very well. But I needed that. I needed that to calm me down.
Sure.
You know,
and you said, too, just thinking about the wine is the base. Wine. Sweet night. Jesus.
It was good.
I bet it calmed you down.
It did.
You did say that one night around this time. You were able to have your parents were able to watch your kids so that you could go out with some friends for a night, just to have a night off, break.
Right.
Tell us what happened that night.
Oh, my. Well, we were drinking and we're having a good time. It was a neighborhood bar and it was closing time. And the only people left were the guy I was with and the two bartenders. So basically closed the place, as they say. And Scranton was like that. You know, people would drink till closing and they'd go to after hours places or they'd go to the all night diner. You know, you're a night owl. Well, I couldn't do that too often, but that night I did. And we came out of this bar, the four of us, and this car comes speeding down Pittston Avenue, which is like the main street in South Scranton. And he jumps out of the car, runs up, punches me square in the face, and I was unconscious. He punched me. I was on the ground unconscious. And before the guys could do anything, he ran back in his car and drove away.
Oh my God, that's horrible. Was he arrested?
Well, of course, I thought, oh, I have three witnesses. So I did file an arrest report. Mm-hmm. And we went to grand jury. And I testified, and all three men testified. But when I was being testified by the grand jury, it's the assistant DA that does it. He's the one that wants the case to be a true bill. But he was painting me like I was this whore, you know, like, well, you were out in a bar. And it was 2 a.m. And I was thinking, yeah, so, you know. And we waited for the verdict of that. And it came back that it was not going to go to trial. And I was furious. I'm thinking I had three witnesses with me. So I went right to the district attorney's office in the courthouse. That's where we were. Mm-hmm. And I walked in and I said, I don't know who you know that he knows or if there was money paid or what the situation, but I'm going to let you know right now I'm leaving here and I'm going to go buy a gun. And he said to me, you shouldn't tell me that. And I responded, oh, yes, I should tell you that because that was bullshit what just happened, that you let him off. So I didn't buy a gun that day, but I was very... so furious.
So what happened then with your ex? I have to imagine that he still was tormenting you, perhaps, still in your life.
He kept it up. And finally, I tried moving out of town.
Okay.
But I had to stay in Pennsylvania because I didn't want to have to refile for everything, like food stamps and all that stuff,
right,
in another state. So I went to a place called Chambersburg, and the college was in Chambersburg, and I got a trailer in Shippensburg to live with my two children, and I got them in daycare down there, and I started to go to college, and he found out I was down there, and he showed up. So I was like, oh my God. So he shows up, and of course, you know, there were many, many times where he was like, I love you, forgive me, I'll never act like that again, take me back, da-da. So he did all that, and I said no. And then I went home for the weekend to see my parents, and I brought the kids with me. And I assume you're going to know what this is. 3 Mile Island happened.
Island. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, if you look where it's located, it's right in the middle of where I was living.
Oh, so you lost basically where you were living.
Well, what happened was it was a atomic meltdown, nuclear meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't know what was going to happen with air quality, water quality. There's no way I could take my two little girls back there.
Of course.
Yeah. So I had to drop out and go back to Scranton. And I got an apartment. My parents' house, they had an apartment for me. So I moved back to Scranton, but I just couldn't get back into the flow of college because it was like I quit mid-semester and, you know, one thing after another.
So at this point, it sounds like, okay, so you try to get out, he finds you. Then obviously, act of God or whatever you want to call it with that horrible disaster. It's like you can't go back, you can't go forward, you just are kind of stuck.
Rock and a hard place, absolutely.
And is he still begging you to take him back?
Yeah, he wants, but he's also being more physical too, and accusing me of things. In fact, he wore me down to the point where I did take him back for a short time. I tried because of the children.
Mm-hmm.
He was making some money bartending, and I tried taking him back. But then I couldn't. Like, physically, it made me sick. It's physically sick to be in the same bed with him, never mind anything else happening. And I just, after, I don't even think it was a week, and I said, this isn't going to work. You have to leave. It's not going to work. And that was when he was yelling and carrying on, but he was packing a suitcase. And every time he'd go by me, he'd kick me. So he'd be packing, he'd go to the drawer, he'd get something, he'd come back, he'd kick me again. I was sitting on the edge of the bed. And I said, if you kick me one more time, I am not responsible for what I might do. And he kicked me one more time. And you know how people say everything goes black and they don't even know they did something?
Yep.
Well, that's what happened with me. And at that time, they had those like princess phones, you know, small handheld phone, home telephone. And in that blackness, I picked up the phone and shoved it right into his face, and he broke his nose.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what was his reaction to that?
He was in the bathroom trying to get his nose to stop bleeding, and he was practically crying, saying, oh, you broke my nose. I'm never going to forgive you for that.
Even though he had punched you in the face and had been physically abusing you.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
in that moment, just that you just said, was kicking you as you're sitting on the edge of the bed.
Yes, yes. Well, he's absolutely, I'm not a psychologist, but there's different personality types that, you know, they don't think like we do. Narcissist or borderline personality disorder. I don't know what he was or is. But so he left. But he then was telling people in the bars and laughing about it and said, oh, she broke my nose. Like, he liked that I was feisty or something. Okay. He was like bragging about it. I don't understand either. Don't worry.
Okay.
don't understand either.
So he leaves again. And you know, the hope here is that you're able to move on. But there was another night where you were out with friends and you were having a nightcap with the bartender and another patron. Tell us what happened that night.
They had a big clam bake, big political thing, and people love to go to it because free beer. And the knowledge is saying in Scranton was there's only two types of drinkers.
Okay.
The ones that are in the bar or the ones that are in the AA meeting.
Jesus Christ.
There's no gray area.
And were you, I know.
That time I was in the bar.
You were in the bar. Okay. And were you drinking a lot?
I had started to drink more. I never drank till I was 21. And I really didn't like drinking. But then when you're married to an alcoholic, the first husband, and also in the bar business, you start to get accustomed to alcohol and realize that it has a sedating effect, a calming effect sometimes. I had increased my drinking for sure. Yeah. So we were at this clam bake, and I'm walking around and I see this guy that he was an amateur boxer, and he was a frenemy of my ex's.
And say frenemy?
Frenemy.
Okay.
You've heard that word before.
I have. Just like I know what a bong is.
That's why you're so surprised it's coming out of my mouth, though.
Well, no, I'm still the most surprised by the wine in the bong.
Never did that, huh?
No, not myself. No. No.
Just love him. So I asked this boxer. I said, listen, you know, he's 6'4". He's 270 pounds. Like, how do I win a fight with him? Like, give me some pointers.
Okay.
See, because I was scrappy. That's one thing. I was not going to be in the corner crying, you know?
Uh-huh.
He said, well, here's the thing. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. And the secret is to get in the first punch. Like, you have to hit him first. So if you think he's going to hit you, you have to hit him first.
Oh, wow.
So I'm trying to get tips from a boxer. I defend myself.
Now, did you ever, I hope, did you ever have to use that?
Well, I did, because there was a situation where he was coming towards me And it happened to be raining that day, so I had an umbrella with me. And I saw him coming, and I remembered what Eddie told me, and I hit him right in the head with the umbrella. But it was, you know, not going to do it much damage, but it did stop him in his tracks. I think he was surprised.
You know? Yeah, it probably startled the hell out of him.
Yeah, that was before the phone. I get things mixed up. It's been a lot of years.
Oh, no, it's okay. And at some point, though, you did become remarried, right?
Well, what happened was I was at this landing, and I'm walking around, and I run into my first husband. And, you know, just like Natalie Wood and Elizabeth Taylor, who like to remarry their exes.
Yep.
So I still found him attractive. It had been 10 years since we were divorced or saw each other. And we felt the spark was still there. And I started seeing him secretly. And we didn't go into any place public. We would go to his place. Uh-huh. And did not want my ex to find out. And supposedly I thought I was still in love with him and that he had changed and all this stuff. So I didn't marry him right away, but we moved in together. And I knew he would stand up for me. He wouldn't there'd be a second date and a third. He was going to stay. Okay?
Okay.
Now, he was half the size of Bob, but, you know, he was with me. And, of course, Bob didn't like that. And the one day we were just sitting watching TV and he was second floor apartment, and he comes running up the stairs and into the apartment, and he grabs Jack, and he starts fighting with him, and they're rolling around on the floor. And I'm like, I don't believe this is happening. And there was like a big, heavy mug or something on the table. I forget what it was. Something that wouldn't break. And I picked it up, and I hit Bob in the head with it. Just to stop this little sparring match. And when I did that, he left.
And was he still calling you names and saying that you shouldn't be with anybody else? And
The abuser, the stalker, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, so you got him out of there after you hit him with that object.
The object was, his skull was too thick to haven't caused much damage. But then that's the thing. He saw that this guy wasn't going to get scared off. That was his intention.
Gotcha.
So he had to back off. So he did back off. And I stayed with Jack, who was my first husband. And we bought a bar together.
Oh, wow.
We bought a little neighborhood bar. Well, I'm a very good salesperson.
Okay, I could see that.
And I was bartending at a place that was for sale, a little neighborhood place. And I knew the game because I had worked in all these bars and hotels. And I knew that the vendors, the people that bring the machines, like the poker machines, et cetera, they're the real source of money. So when the vendor came, I talked to him. And I said, I'd like to buy this bar. Will you give me the down payment, which was $5,000? And he said, yes. And it was a verbal agreement that I would put his poker machines in the bar, if you know about me, how that stuff works. And then we would divide the profits. And the profits from the machine would end up paying back my loan.
Mm.
So I basically was getting a business without having any money.
Yeah, pretty good salesperson.
I'm excellent. Because there was a couple that wanted to buy it. And they said to him, oh, well, they're not married. Like, as if that would make a difference, you know? And it didn't. So we bought this place and we had great business. And I did wonderful during the day. And the machines were paying off what we owed. But what would happen would be Jack would be the night bartender and he wouldn't charge his friends for drinks.
Oh.
And we were losing. I had to go get food stamps again. Oh, I don't have the bar.
Yeah.
They asked me, how could you be applying? I said, well, here's my books. I brought in the books, showed them that I was bleeding money. Didn't tell them about the poker money because that was illegal to begin with. Right? So that didn't work out. And then it turned out his cheating was worse than ever. I think she was a sex addict, actually. And I didn't know what that was then.
Well, did you guys get remarried or did you just have a relationship and on the bar together?
He ended up getting remarried because before I realized how bad he was, he asked me and I did. We had a civil servant and we did get remarried.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't long after that that like all this stuff was coming up, all these women that I would catch him with. And I started doing something called like revenge adultery. So in other words, if your husband cheats on you for spite, you go and cheat on him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see.
So I had a guy that fell in love with me and he even confronted Jack and told him he doesn't treat me right and I'm better off with him. And they were both standing in front of me and they made me choose.
Jesus.
I know, it was fun. But I chose Jack because and sometimes I wonder, well, I know, who knows? This guy could have been just as bad. But anyway, after that, I said, we've got to get rid of this bar. So I was able to sell the bar and take that money and buy a mobile home.
Okay.
So that again I was trying to like scratch myself up that mountain, you know, like little by little. And the men in my life kept dragging me back down.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get that metaphor. And so now I buy the mobile home. Well, he's out of work all the time. It was horrible again. So I was with him 6 years. And I said, you have to go. I turned him out many times, you know, but he did the please take me back, I'm sorry thing. And he was very attractive and charming. And, you know, I'd fall for it. And then he'd get kicked out again. I'd throw all his clothes in the garbage or whatever. So finally I had enough. And I said, go. And as soon as I got divorced from him, the phone rang and it was Bob.
This is the ex who had been abusing you.
Stalker, yeah, the abusive one. It's been 6 years now. I'll forget. 6 years. And he was like, oh, you're single again. And I'm like, don't even try. Don't even try. He was ready to pick up where she left off.
How did he find out you were single?
Scranton's like a small town. Everybody knows everybody. All three of my husbands were born in South Scranton. Not just Scranton, South Scranton.
Okay.
Well, everybody knows everybody, you know, that kind of thing.
So, you know, you had said to me too when we spoke before, you wrote this and we were emailing. You said after 4 decades of self detrimental behavior, 3 divorces, psychoanalytical treatment, stopovers at inpatient facilities, counseling, and 12-step programs, I finally found a little happiness. What I didn't find was joy.
Right.
Can you explain what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I got sober and I met and married my third husband while I was still drinking and he was still drinking. So we were drinking buddies and we had gone to high school together, but didn't really know each other then. And we bought a bar together, we got married and everything was roses. And I fell into a deep depression and there was no reason I should be depressed. I mean, I had everything I wanted. He treated me with respect. He loved me. The kids were doing well. I wasn't getting harassed anymore. I had money to spend, but I would wake up every morning, not that I wanted to die, but I didn't necessarily want to live. And that's depression. So. Right. I had to do something.
Okay.
And that, you know, I I found that I was having blackouts. My friends start telling me that's my drinking had got to this point. And I was in a car accident, and they gave me painkillers and muscle relaxers, and they said, don't drink with it. Well, of course, I'm not going to listen. Uh-huh. Because I my tolerance for alcohol by then was so high that I could probably drink a fifth in one day. So to have one or two drinks to me meant, oh, that's nothing. But it was something. So people said, Marie, you know what you did last night? And I didn't like that. I did not like not knowing that. I didn't like that. So I went to a place where a friend of mine always went when he got too bad, when he went too overboard with drugs. And I thought it was a spa, but it wasn't. It was a rehab. So I accidentally got sober.
And I know that's hard work and obviously to be sober. So how long have you been sober?
33 years.
Oh, congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah, never had a relapse.
That's amazing.
Well, I was in rehab for 28 days. I got sober. And then 9 months sober, I had gained 50 pounds because I picked up food, because I do that. You give up one addiction, you pick up another, because you still haven't worked on the stuff that you need to work on. And I went away again for 3 weeks to California for eating disorder. Still didn't drink. Came back. And then 5 years sober, I fell into depression. And I went to a family of origin program for a week. So I did a lot of work. And 9 years of therapy, straight therapy. Lot of work.
And through that work, is that how you have found the courage to share such a difficult story publicly?
Well, I have to say that I just never had the time or opportunity to write a book. And so I did all that work, and I shared my story when I would sponsor other women, and I would share my story when I would speak at AA meetings. But 2020, I got depressed because I was in the house all the time. My husband has Parkinson's. I have an autoimmune situation. So we didn't leave the house. And I started being mean to him, which I knew for me was a sign of depression. So I called my doctor, and I went into counseling, and I had antidepressants prescribed. And it was my therapist that said that I write. Just write, not write a book, but just write. So every day I would go and write. And that's where the book came from.
And what is the name of your book?
Raised by Wolves, Trapped by Demons. The wolves were my parents, and the demons were at first the men, and then later inside demons.
Sure. And where can people find that?
Oh, it's on Amazon and Audible.
And we'll put a link in the show notes to that, to make sure that people can. And because obviously, you know, in this one episode, we're not going to cover all of that. When people do pick up your book, you know, what is the message that you hope readers will take away from your story?
That if you dig deep down, you will find the resolve and the grit to keep going no matter what, and that you have more resilience than you even know, because that's what I did. No matter what, I just did the next thing. So, and there's light at the end of the tunnel. You just have to keep moving. You'll get there.
And it's about doing the work, embracing our struggles, and then we do find the light.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Embracing struggles is the main thing.
Yeah. And I think the last question before we wrap up, I want to ask you is, and what advice would you give to someone who has suffered from childhood trauma? Maybe somebody who's listening who had a similar upbringing to yours or had other traumatic events in their childhood.
You need to talk to somebody. I mean, you absolutely talk therapy. I don't care if it's an AA sponsor or psychologist or whoever. I think that's really, really important. And also, and this, for me, for sure, you'll get triggered. Sometimes you get triggered by things. And when you get triggered, that's when you need to sit down and say, oh, why am I triggered? Like if somebody blows you off and this is an appointment or it's late or whatever it is, and you get mad, don't just get mad. Think about it. Like, why am I mad? Because through that, I found out through my triggers that it was abandonment issues and safety issues and trust issues. And then I look at it and I go, oh, that's why, you know, I'm like that. So yeah, look at yourself and talk to people. Not everybody, but you know,
well, sure, especially right.
When somebody you trust,
guy at the bus stop, postman.
Yeah. Well, I talk to everybody, but not like
that. Yeah, maybe that's not for everybody, right? Well, we've covered a lot, and like I said, a lot more. The richness of the story will be even more told in the book. So, as we're wrapping up, is there anything else that you wanted to share or say that maybe you did not get a chance to say during the episode?
Well, I have a YouTube channel, and that's called Be Heard, Empowering Women.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my podcast, which is also titled Be Heard, Empowering Women. And I just wrote my third book, which is a workbook to help heal from trauma and abuse. And I think my voice will hold up real quick. When I was at that wedding last year and called, there was a 16-year-old boy there, a friend of my grandson's. And when I went over to introduce myself, he turned around and he said, "Are you Kondo Mimi? That's my handle on social media, is Kondo Mimi."
Okay.
And I said, "Yes, I am." And he was like blushing. And he said, "I can't believe this is happening." And I would be mad. I'm like, did Taylor Swift just walk in? And my grandson comes running over and he said, "Nana, he is your biggest fan. He read your book and he follows you on Instagram." Okay. And I was just amazed by that. And then he wanted to take a selfie. We took a selfie, and I went to give my number to him to get the picture. And my grandson grabbed the phone out of his hand and said, "You're not getting my grandmother's phone." Now, that's the funny part, but the serious part is I went home and I thought about it, and I said, you know, I'm always keying all my stuff towards women. This is a 16-year-old boy. So he inspired me. And I'm going to write another workbook that's non-gender specific about healing from trauma and abuse.
Oh, I look forward to that for sure.
And if you look me up on Instagram and TikTok, you'll see I have a reel all about that experience with pictures and giving him credit, just initials, KC. I wasn't going to embarrass him to say his whole name.
Hey, KC, I know those initials. Those are my initials.
Isn't that funny?
It is so funny.
When the book comes out and it says dedicated to KC, you could say it's you.
Yeah, damn right. I'm going to just start lying about that shit. Well, listen, Mimi, and I'm going to find you on Instagram right after this, Kondo Mimi. Thank you so much for sharing
Kondo
your story.
Mimi 1948. Kondo Mimi 1948.
1948. Got it. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing your story. And seriously, and I mean this, to go through all of what you went through while raising two children and have come out on the other side with your life working and helping to empower women. And as you said, anyone really is just a testament to your strength and your resilience. So I commend you for that. So kudos to you.
Thank you very much.
And
thank you for having me.
Yes. And we will put a link to your podcast. We're going to put a link to all your social stuff, all that good stuff in the show notes. Yeah. And so we can make sure that people go check out what you have. So thank you very much, Mimi. I really appreciate it. To everyone else, I'll end the show as I always try to, which is a reminder that there's always room for kindness and grace. Even with ourselves, there is always room for kindness and grace. And we'll see you next time on Sad Times.
You've been listening to a Fourth Hand Joint.